Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Project Zion podcast. This is Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history, and I'm your host, Karen Peter. Today's episode is the first in a new series of episodes where we're going to engage in conversations about the historical and theological journey of Community of Christ. Now, our guests for these discussions are Locke McKay and Tony Shavala Smith. Locke is an historian, the director of Community of Christ Historic Sites, and he serves on the Council of 12 Apostles. Tony is a theologian who teaches scripture and theology at Community of Christ Seminary and at Graceland University. Both Locke and Tony are familiar to Project Zion listeners, but we welcome them today as well. Now, our plan is to have a series of 12 episodes that follow the development of the early church, the reorganization, and the journey as Community of Christ. And we're going to touch on important events and their historical and cultural context, as well as theological developments and their impact on the church. So as I said, this is a new series of episodes, and this is our first one. So we're going to spend some time kind of laying the groundwork, if you will, for our conversations, talking a bit about where our story came from and what the setting was from which it came. So we're going to start with Locke. I flipped a coin on this to decide whether we were going to start with Locke or Tony. And Locke, you won, if we want to look at it that way, and you get to go first. So let's talk a little bit about the historical context and the things we need to keep in mind as we discuss church history.
So I think it's important to start every discussion of church history with an exploration of how we approach history and Community of Christ. And it's not always been that way, some of the things I'm going to share. But I think it's critically important when exploring our past to just keep a number of things in mind. So the church history principles, critically important. Number one, continuing exploration of our history informs our identity. So a people with a shared memory of their past and an informed understanding of its meaning are better prepared to chart their way into the future. Number two, history informs but does not dictate our faith and beliefs. Sound history informs faith, and healthy faith leads to insights about history. But our past does not limit our faith and beliefs to what they were historically. The short version of that is our history is not our theology. And that's a different approach than some people take, but it's so, so very important. The church encourages honest, responsible historical scholarship. I'd say beginning in the 1960s, although there were some outliers earlier than that, but beginning in the 1960s, we really tried to start professionalizing our history program and our understandings of how to do church history. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. Something that is increasingly a problem, though, is I encounter regularly now presentism, and our church history principles caution us to avoid it. Presentism, we're interpreting the past based on a current worldview and culture instead of on the culture of the time. It takes a lot of work to understand things in their cultural context, but again, critically important when doing church history. And we are getting worse and worse at that, in my experience in the US anyway. Number four, the study of church history is a continuing journey. So our conclusions are open to correction as new understandings and information come from ongoing study. Sometimes it's painful to admit that we got something wrong, but we have to. I've spent a lot of hours writing papers that I found a new source the next day and had to throw everything out. And That's just the way the process works.
And that's really hard for a lot of people in the community of Christ who grew up with a different understanding of the church's story. So this is a key point in our church history principles.
And that may be the difference between the story of the church and the history of the church. there is a difference. And I think I've touched on that. Number five, seeing both the faithfulness and human flaws in our history make it more believable and realistic, not less. We need to try and understand by learning as much as possible about the context. That's going to be a theme that I think both Tony and I will lift up throughout our time together. The result when doing that is empathy instead of judgment. Our scriptures are consistent in pointing out that God uses imperfect people. And our more recent church history is consistent in pointing out that God uses imperfect people. One of my current favorite examples of understanding things in context, I believe you can't understand Nauvoo without viewing it through the lens of the atrocities of Missouri. And I want to be clear that I believe that we shared culpability for those atrocities. We were not the innocents there. We shared responsibility for what happened, but we were also deeply scarred by those experiences. And that played a really important role in some of the decisions, and I think sometimes awful decisions that we made in Nauvoo. I guess we'll have a chance to talk more about that when we get to the Nauvoo period. Mm-hmm. Number six, the responsible study of church history involves learning, repentance, and transformation. As a church focused on promoting communities of reconciliation, justice, and peace, we need to be self-critical and honest about our history. It's important for us to confess when we have been less than what the gospel calls us to be. One of my favorite examples here is a Hans Mill anniversary where Andrew Bolton was invited to speak. And he pointed out that the Missourians had apologized for the extermination order, which I don't think meant leave or we'll kill you. I think it meant leave or we'll forcibly remove you. But the Missourians had apologized. Andrew pointed out that we had never apologized for our actions, like attacking the Missouri State Militia at Crooked River. I think it was inadvertent. We didn't know they were the militia. Let me clarify. The attack was not inadvertent. It was intentional. But we didn't know we were attacking the militia. We thought they were a mob. But either way, that's treason. We attacked the militia. We should apologize for the things we got wrong there. That is what it means, I think, to confess. We have been less than what the gospel calls us to be. Number seven, the church has a long-standing tradition that it does not legislate or mandate positions on matters of church history. Historians need to be free to draw their own conclusions after thorough consideration of the evidence. So I respect people who have very different interpretations than I do. I don't think it's my mission to change their interpretations. I think it's important to do the best we can to interpret the sources that we have. We're getting close to the end. Number eight, we need to create a respectful culture of dialogue about matters of history. And we should not limit our story to one perspective. We occasionally would do that in our past. We now understand that diverse viewpoints bring richness to our understanding of God at work and our sacred story. So there's not just one telling of the story or the history. Number nine, our faith is grounded in God's revelation in Jesus Christ and the continuing guidance of the Holy Spirit. Jesus Christ was and is the foundation of our faith and the focus of the church's mission and message. And when we actually live that out, that makes it a lot easier to still engage with some of the flawed folks in our past. So it's not about Joseph, for example. It's about Jesus.
Thanks, Locke. A couple of things that you brought up just from the history principles before we go any further. For our community of Christ listeners, a lot of times in the field, I will get this question. And so I would like you to go back to number eight. Is what you're telling me the church's official story of our history? So in the past, we had that.
Yeah.
How would you respond?
I would say that Community Christ doesn't take positions on historical matters. We encourage open, honest, historical scholarship, wherever that leads. Kind of an interesting way that has been lived out when Todd Compton's book on the plural lives of Joseph Smith came out. It was extraordinarily controversial in some Latter-day Saint communities, and he was getting attacked pretty viciously. Our response when asked about the book was to say, we support good scholarship wherever that leads. Now, I wish we would have gone a little further and said, and we think this is good scholarship.
All right. So everybody listening, Amazon's going to have a run on a text that may or may not be still in print. So is there anything else you want to add to kind of foundation how we look at the church history, Locke, before we go to Tony for setting the stage for our theological context? We'll come back to the specific points in this kind of period of time.
I just want to reinforce context is critical. So very, very important. And that's not easy to do. It's increasingly difficult to do these days because we want to learn everything we need to know about a topic in a very short period of time. I don't even think we want to read an article. We want to read a sentence and understand it. And that's just not the way it works.
Well, yeah, I want to Google it and get Wikipedia's little blurb, and then I know what I'm talking about. Yeah, absolutely.
I like Wikipedia, but it might be a place to start. It's definitely not the place to finish.
Yeah, and it's not a source to cite in a graduate level paper.
Ah, thank you for reminding us of that. So with that, Tony, maybe we'll launch into what are some principles, if you will, that we need to keep in mind for our theological exploration of our story.
Sure. So let's start with our standard working definitions of theology as faith seeking understanding, right? And faith asking questions. And here, for the sake of discussion, faith here is one sense of being grasped by the ultimate. I'll put it that way. One sense of being grasped by the ultimate and one's response to that being grasped by. So we want to understand that. One of the analogies I often use for trying to understand what theology as a discipline is the analogy of falling in love, right? So, when a person falls in love with another person, it's something that sort of happens to you. Now there's elements of choice in it, but something happens to you. But then subsequent to that, it's really, really critical, important to try to understand what this is about, what this relationship means, what it could mean, how I'm going to function in it. So theology is kind of like that. It's a discipline of trying to make sense of this being grasped by the ultimate that's happened to us. So another way to put this is that the object of theology is not the past. The object of theology is theos, God, but not just any old God, God whose self-emptying love is revealed in Jesus Christ. That's Christian theology, right? Now there's Islamic theologies, Jewish theologies, and so on. Christian theology's primary object is God who reveals God's self decisively in the person of Jesus Christ. That's the object of theology, and not the past per se. But the sources of theology, our standard sources for theology are scripture, tradition, experience, and reason. And so right away you can see, well, if tradition is that which has been handed on to us from the past, then history does figure into the theologian's reflections. Modern and postmodern theology takes the discipline of history very seriously. And most theologians I know, including myself, are trained as critical historians kind of simultaneously, right? When I was a PhD student, I took one of my best courses was in ecclesiastical historiography, learning how to think, research, reflect on the history of Christian doctrine, the history of Christian thought, the history of Christianity, critically, but in the context of doing faith-seeking understanding. So the past matters to theologians. I mean, the revelation of God in Jesus Christ is a past event. still always happening, but a past event. That's its benchmark. So we have to do history. And the critical theologian will say amen to pretty much everything Locke said about how you do history, right? History is not, it's not critical history if church authorities are spinning the answer. That's ideology. That's apologetics. That's flummy-diddle. That's another word. but it's not critical history. And so theologians have to teach churches not to be afraid of critical history, because one of the things that the theologian and the historian share in common is this passion for the truth. Right? Now, the truth is a great big word, and there's different kinds of truth, but the historian is passionate about trying to understand the past as best as she can on its own terms. The theologian's concern for truth is the truthfulness, faithfulness with which the church in its own present context is trying to articulate what this message is, this good news, this gospel is. So different sides of the same thing, but we're still both interested in truth. And both historians and theologians they ought to be very allergic to any kind of falsification or meddling with with the object of study. So I'm trained in several disciplines. I usually identify myself as a historical theologian. And historical theologians are theologians who are concerned about the church's message and mission for today, but especially focus on the past Christian tradition, looking for insights, things we've forgotten, things we've missed, things we didn't see, things we couldn't see because we didn't have the right lenses that might help inform, influence, and guide Christian faith for today. You know what? One of my favorite lines to describe what I do is that line from the movie. I think the movie's called Sixth Sense. I see dead people. And I'm surrounded by them here in Charmaine's in my office. I've got icons everywhere. Right now I'm looking at a picture. You can't see it, but I'm looking at a picture of the great Anglican Archbishop William Temple, who's one of my mentors and heroes. Not living mentors. He died in 1944, but you know what I mean. So Christian theology stays in conversation with the church's past. We don't just make stuff up as we go along. We have to stay in conversation because it may be that some figure, some theologians, some mystics in the past actually grasped the revelation of God in Christ more clearly than our contemporaries might. And so we can learn from them, learn things from them. So, you know, when we start examining Community of Christ history, what the theologian will do is the theologian relies on the critical historian to say, here's what happened. And then the theologian will do something that will feel like presentism to the historian, but I don't think it is. It's more like 1842, given what could be known about the Christian faith on the American frontier, how much did Joseph Smith Jr.'s speculations align with that or depart from that? And were there church members who thought there was a departure? And the answer is yes, there were. They published it briefly in 1844, a thing called the Nauvoo Expositor, and they thought this thing is going off the rails. And that's an example of how what could be known about the Christian faith was available in that time. And so it's for the theologian, it's okay. We find if we do this carefully and sensitively, it's okay to say, in this particular event, this was a distortion of what could be known about Christianity, or this was a derailing of what could be known about Christianity. So we have to do that. One of my areas of scholarly and existential interest is what happened to Christianity in Germany in the 1930s. And I can look and study this, and I can see, first, I want to be a critical historian. I want to understand as much as possible what was going on in its contextual terms. But then as a theologian, I have a different set of truth questions. how did this align with the gospel as it was known then? All right, so that's a that's maybe a slight divergence from I might be more inclined than Locke on different issues in church history to say, what in the heck were they thinking? You know what?
Well, then these will be interesting conversations that we have in our episodes as we go along.
You know, yeah, I want to know about communitarianism in Kirtland. I also want to know about Fanny Alger. Yeah. And I want to know what was going on there. And so, but, you know, like the critical historian, I'm not afraid to find skeletons in our closet because as a theologian, I already work with a concept called original sin, right? Everybody's messed up. So I can work with that pretty easily. A couple of more things and then we'll move on. But I love that Locke reinforced that our history is not our theology. And I agree, good history, faithful, honest, critical history can inform our theology, and it really needs to. Ideologically motivated history, bad history, can deform our theology too. And so we have to be really careful about how we bring these disciplines together. We don't want to tell a false story about the past. And here's the reason why. I've said this before publicly. I've said it to Mark Shearer before, and I think he agreed with me. I said, in my conversation with Mark, I said, Mark, history actually, as a discipline, is a subdivision of ethics. Right? And you think, what? Well, wait, ethics is philosophy. How can history be a subdivision of ethics? And I said, memory is essential to conscience. No memory, no conscience. Bad memory, bad conscience, or bad consciousness. And so it's really the historian functioning as a critical historian is essential to our ethical life so that we grasp what happened on its own terms as best we can, but also recognize that there may have been other things that could have been done and definitely things that we would do differently. So in order for us to live with conscience about our past, we have to know the truth. Hey, this is true in personal life too. You know, you can't, you know, in this respect, history is like therapy, right? It's it's a plumbing through your life to say, oh, actually, I did this. I've always said I did this, but really what I did was this. And that's kind of messed things up for a while. So, and finally, history, I think Locke would agree with this. And I think he pretty much said this. History is a moving target, right? Because we discover new things. We discover new sources. Locke has to rewrite papers because he was just about to turn it in and he found a new source. And it's like, well, darn. But also present knowledge and experience give us different lenses we didn't have before to understand the past differently. For example, in American cultural life, for a while, starting in 2020, we really started becoming conscious of how deeply embedded racism was in American social, political, and policing structures. And we started to have a conversation about it, but that got politically sidetracked, derailed, sadly. But it's now really quite impossible for critical historians to understand American history without the lens of racism. It would be false consciousness to talk about Andrew Jackson moving the natives out west without now being able to see that as part of a long contextual stream of racism that's deeply embedded in American life. And so new experience, not just new sources, but new experience, new cultural awareness gives the historian new lenses for going back over the past and saying, oh my goodness, I never saw this before, but what was actually happening there? That was an expression of the same kind of racism that started in 1619 and before in the exploitation of Africa and so on. So those are some things that I come at this with in terms of theology. My primary aim is always to help the church of the present live into its future with a message of good news about God's self-emptying, self-giving love in Christ. That's my primary thing. But hey, like I said, I see dead people.
Thank you, Tony. I think our listeners already will be anticipating some interesting conversations, and I think a new way to process our story. So in the life of the church, sometimes we have kind of taken the idea that because we're talking about religious history, that religious history equals sacred history equals holy history. And if it's holy, we can't touch it. We can't explore it. We can't open it up and really examine it. And what I hear both of you saying is, no, this, the fact that it's sacred or religious history means we should open it up and examine it to be more faithful and authentic in our living out our story today. So I appreciate that. So Locke, I want to come back to you. You've kind of told us how we'll be looking at our story historically, but can you begin to now set the stage, if you will, on the context that we need to have a bit of information on if we're going to really understand the beginning, the inception of what we have come to know as Community of Christ or the Restoration, our branch of the Restoration tradition?
Can I ask Tony a question first?
Oh, I'm sorry. Absolutely. I had that on our notes that you had time for questions. Let's go back. Locke, do you have any questions for Tony?
I would love to ask Tony a question. I'm not sure if I understood clearly your understanding of the relationship between historical understanding and truth. Do you understand them to be one and the same or not one and the same?
I would say truth is a really mega concept, right? There's historical truth, there's scientific truth, there's biological truth, there's gender truth, there's existential personal truth, there's theological truth. In other words, truth, this is a horrible image, but think of truth as the disco ball that's reflecting things from all angles. I mean, holy cow, does that ever date me? But
that all of us on this call laughed when you said that dates all of us, so go ahead.
So history is interested in truth. It's interested as much as possible in trying to understand what happened, why it happened, what were the forces shaping it, what contextual factors figured into that, what can we currently know about what happened at Far West, right? Without spin, but with the use of the best sources, the best tools, the best lenses, that's a search for a kind of truth. Does that help?
That helps a lot. That'll be helpful as we continue our discussions.
Okay. Locke, you want to go on to context?
I would love to. So just like I generally talk about church history principles whenever I'm talking about Community of Christ history, I also love to talk about communitarians, utopians, and Christian primitivists, which is part of the context of what's happening around us. And I think the communitarian element is particularly helpful in understanding some of what the heck was going on in Nauvoo. And not necessarily why, but at least maybe helping to give us some insight. So our story in context, there was this explosion in the early 19th century of groups like us who believed that living and working in community was a better idea. Some are earlier, some are later. There was something happening, not just in the U.S., but in the U.S. and Europe that was causing people to ask questions about how they should live their lives. And so for small groups of people, they were landing on this idea of living and working in community. Folks like Shakers, founded by Mother Ann Lee. And I'm really interested in the connections between these various communitarian groups, the way that we interacted, trading members and leaders and ideas. So for example, with the Shakers, Jesse Goss, a member of our very first presidency, was a Shaker before he joined us and went back to the Shakers. So I'm just really interested in what, if any, influence he had that might have been transmitted through the Shakers. Some of the ways that they believed in living in community, sharing all things common, simple living, and there's, as Larry Foster has pointed out in his work, there's something about living in community that raised questions about the nature of family and how to interact with others. So sexuality, sexual relationships generally work their way into the mix for some reason. So, of course, Shakers, they choose celibacy. And others, as we'll discover, take different routes. An extreme example of another route are the Oneidans in upstate New York, founded by John Humphrey Noyes. They also shared all things common. They had some pretty interesting practices like mutual criticism, where every member of the community would gather around one individual and spend hours pointing out their flaws and sharing ways that they could live better lives. Sounds like a horrific experience to me. They also practiced complex marriage, where everybody was married to everybody else. Others, the Harmonists, Harmony, Pennsylvania, New Harmony, Indiana, back to Economy, Pennsylvania, founded by Father George Rapp. Among our connections to them were Sidney Rigdon, who lived near their community in Economy, Pennsylvania. And our earliest German members were previously Harmonists, folks like the Zundel family. They shared all things common. They gave money to those in need. They collected huge amounts of money to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. They're caring for the poor by providing food and housing. They also chose to practice celibacy, trying to purify themselves in preparation for the turn of Christ. That ended up causing a schism. That's why some of those folks ended up joining the Latter-day Saints. And even folks like the Inspirationalists at the Amana colonies. So all of these groups and us, examples of communitarians. So there's something happening in the culture that's causing people to think that we need to live and work together in community. Some of it is driven by this desire to replicate the Book of Acts and this kind of Bible communism, some have called it. Some of it is a reaction, I think, to the Industrial Revolution, but there's significant changes in the society at the time. We're also utopians, as were many of the groups I just talked about and more. So for example, as the Latter-day Saints are driven from Nauvoo, they are looking for other communal groups to sell to. They try connecting with the Owenites and are not successful. They eventually sell the temple lot to the Icarians, French utopians, who had this dream of building a perfect society they called Icaria, similar to our concept of Zion. So communitarians, utopians, and Christian primitivists. Andrew Bolton, I think, has done a nice job of talking about our Christian primitivist past, and particularly the influence of the Book of Acts on us, this idea where we are desperately trying to physically recreate what we understood of New Testament Christianity on the shores of Lake Erie. And Acts seems to be the template for much of that. So, for example, living in a gathered community of believers, because that's what's described in the Book of Acts, from Acts chapter 2, verse 1, and when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. Joseph restates that in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 32, 2a, the Community of Christ Doctrine and Covenants is December 1830. And again, a commandment I give unto the church that it is expedient in me that they should assemble together at the Ohio. So this idea of gathering together with like-minded individuals. We were trying anyway to live a variation of all things common. From Acts chapter 2, verse 44, Joseph restates that in the Book of Commandments, 1831. And behold, thou shalt consecrate all thy properties, that which thou hast unto me, with a covenant and a deed which cannot be broken. Why all things common? Concern for the plight of the poor. The hope is that the surplus of the wealthy can lift up the poor. So from Acts chapter 2, verse 45, they sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all men as every man had need. Restated in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 42. And behold, thou wilt remember the poor and consecrate of thy properties for their support. And inasmuch as ye imparted your substance unto the poor, ye will do it unto me. Expands beyond just Acts 2, this idea that we'll probably talk about later as we're talking about Kirtland Temple, of proclaiming the gospel to the rest of the world. So from Acts chapter 1, verse 8, you will be my witnesses in all Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And that soon grows into this idea of being endowed with power from on high. So they're sending missionaries out really early from Kirtland, and they develop this idea that they have to be spiritually empowered, from Luke 24, this idea that they would have an advantage over those who were not filled with the Holy Spirit. And even, you know, why are we Christians with temples? Acts chapter 2, verse 46, they spent much time together in the temple, resulted in our hope to build 3 houses of the Lord, some called temples in Kirtland, and our hope to build 24 temples in Independence, Missouri. So I think really helpful to understand their focus on the New Testament, particularly Acts. Let me clarify that they were not ignoring the Old Testament, and that soon significant elements are there as well. But I think it's helpful to understand our early Kirtland period through those lenses.
So Locke, when you talk about Christian primitivism, and you were using the different verses out of Acts to, and then comparing what Joseph Smith put in the Doctrine and Covenants, it wasn't just Joseph Smith who was interested in this. I want to make sure our listeners are understanding. There were lots of people experimenting and using pieces of scripture and trying to live them in how they understood to be authentically in their time. So yeah, we were an example of Christian primitivism.
One of many. And what I find really interesting and intriguing, they weren't just symbolically remembering, they meaning early Latter-day Saints, symbolically remembering, they believed they were living again those things. And they were really intentional about it, but because we're not very scripturally literate, we often don't pick up the clues they leave. There's, Sidney Rigdon says something in Kirtland, even before he joins the Latter-day Saints, that is very specific, saying we are trying to do this. But usually they're not saying we're trying to create this again, we're trying to live this again. They're just using language to describe what they're doing that comes right out of the New Testament. So just fascinating.
Okay. So as we become more scripturally literate in our discussions, as we go on, listeners, we will better understand our own story. So Karen, Tony, how about you?
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that. And then I'd like to say a little bit something about revivalism.
Okay.
So so a theologian will look at a setting like that and ask the question, what are the underlying theological or religious assumptions that people have in this setting? And all of these different experiments and primitivism itself as a phenomenon, they share an assumption that I suspect many of us would find not an assumption we would share. And that assumption is that which is oldest is truest. I call that the primitivist fallacy. Right, that which is oldest is truest. And so somehow the only way to have authentic Christianity is to get back and have exactly what they had.
Isn't there another fallacy that there was one Christianity to restore?
Exactly. That's another fallacy, right? That there was an original thing. and it'll be in the 1960s when our church finally officially says, there wasn't an original thing. There were many original things. So yeah, there's multiple fallacies going on there. But when I look at our own tradition, that primitivist fallacy really, really created problems, because if that which is oldest is truest, and you've already gone back to the book of Acts, you know that there's like a whole bunch of books prior to that. And so it must be even truer the further back you go. And so in my view, the primitivist fallacy or the primitivist assumption, that which is oldest is truest, kept motivating Joseph to try to recreate older and older stuff. And before you know it, you've got Egyptian polytheism and theocracy and polygamy, right? I think those are complex phenomena, but part of the reason they could happen is because there was this shared assumption that somehow that which is oldest is truest. And that's an assumption that's an assumption that ought to be in our time ought to be challenged, right? Certainly in other areas of life, we don't believe that. 1920s medicine is older than 2020s medicine. I don't believe I want 1920s medicine. Thank God that it was there because it's part of an evolutionary development. But we in most of in many areas of our lives, we don't function with the idea that which is oldest is truest. So theologically, it's problematic. So that's just one thing to think about primitivism. Another contextual piece that I'm interested in is revivalism, and that period of this. Our movement arises in that period in American history, in American religious history, referred to as the Second Great Awakening, roughly from 1790 to 1840. We fall squarely in the bulk of that, and I like Nathan Hatch's book, The Democratization of American Christianity. It should be titled The Democratization of American Protestant Christianity, I think, more accurately. But he, in my view, he still offers one of the best contextual pieces for understanding lots of aspects of our early theology. And also a fairly good context story, 1820s, 30s context-oriented reading of the Book of Mormon as a piece of 19th century literature. He's really good on all of that. So democratized Christianity in the wake of the American Revolution meant a number of things. It meant that no longer was tradition as received the arbiter of religious truth, but my own personal experience. I have to have an experience. And what I experience is absolute truth for me. Now, that itself has got a lot of problematic assumptions in it, as if the individual is isolated from everything around. But nonetheless, that's the Second Great Awakening has that as one of its working assumptions. You have to experience salvation tonight, or you're going to hell if you die. And thus, the revivalists traded heavily on that assumption that the individual and the individual's private personal religious experience was the final arbiter of Christian truth. That was essential to revivalism. Another thing that was essential to revivalism is the sense that conversion is a one-time thing, right? You, in American religious culture to this day, still, people will still ask you, are you born again? That's straight out of 1820. You know, did you have a born-again experience? Yeah. To which my response is, tell me exactly in the New Testament, when was Peter born again? Because there's a lot of them. But another thing, too, is that the revivalists were popular preachers. They developed persona, right? Some of them pretended to be like John the Baptist or I forget the one, maybe Lot can help me, the one who was called the White Pilgrim. Thomas, maybe. Anyway, they developed colorful persona, and of course they traveled thousands of miles on foot, on horseback, preaching revivals. If you read their stories, many of them have experiences, had call experiences, that sound extremely, extremely like the earliest version of what we call Joseph's first vision, the 1831-2 account of it. Reads pretty much like one of those revivalist preacher call experiences, call conversion experiences. So that means that there was, I'll call it a trope, the trope of the revivalist's conversion experience that was out there, and people knew them, they knew the stories, and Joseph's earliest vision sounds like those stories, not like what we read in the later Wentworth letter. Another thing too is that democratized Christianity meant that I don't need no theological degrees to understand Christianity. And in fact, the people with the theological degrees, those highfalutin Yale and Princeton and Harvard people, they get it wrong all the time. And they're just experts. They claim to be experts, but they don't know anything really. And so the revivalists would pillory the educated clergy from the Northeast. They also really detested Calvinism as they understood it. Of course, they didn't understand Calvinism in terms of its 16th century context. That was not even possible for them. But the idea that salvation is ultimately, finally, in God's hands was deplorable to the revivalists, because you can't preach for conversions if you think people are predestined one way or the other. So they made jokes about Calvinism all the time. This reviling of experts, it has a good side and a bad side, right? The good side is that in the Latter-day Saint tradition, you don't have to be trained. You don't have to be a trained clergy person to be called into priesthood. And there's lots of benefits to that. There's also lots of detriments to that, right? Especially for us today in an age of major risk management questions, right? But the revivalists love to poke fun at all these educated clergy and at the experts. And that's had a long negative half-life in American religious history and American social history. Right. So and interestingly, it didn't work very well, because in order to be a revivalist preacher, you at least had to read. Right. You had to be literate. And while all of that played into early Latter-day Saintism, gosh, as soon as we could, we started establishing schools and schools of prophets and our own little theological seminaries. And we tried to start learning Hebrew. We didn't do great at it, but we tried. And so we knew right away that education was important, even though we had adopted the assumption that a trained, educated clergy is somehow connected to apostasy and falsehood. A view, by the way, we don't hold in pretty much any other area of life, but we did hold it there. So the Second Great Awakening is our matrix. It really deeply impacted our origins. I mean, we originate in it. And so the thing that's one of the things that's really important, for example, in the Book of Mormon, which I read totally as a 19th century text, is have you had the salvation experience, right? The Book of Enos is classic, right? Going out into the woods to let the words of my father sunk, sick grammatical problem there. The words of my father sunk deep into my heart about, you know, redemption and so on. And then he has a vision, right? That's classic Second Great Awakening. Finally, one other thing that's going on too theologically in our origin period is we're still wrestling with the Puritan heritage. The Puritans were in a sense communitarians, but they were also Calvinists. And so there's this whole heritage of Puritanism that's kind of good news, bad news, the American frontier. But the Puritan theological heritage was deeply embedded in the Northeast of the United States. And here's a place you see it. And I'm simply trading a piece out of a lecture I give on the Book of Mormon in a seminary class. So backing up to the 16th century, John Calvin, the great Swiss reformer, one of the ways he referred to God's, you know, God likes to accommodate God's self to human weakness. Calvin uses the word accommodation. And for Calvin, the Bible was a piece of literature that was a divine accommodation to our human needs. And so it's part of the divine love that God kind of makes God's self available to us in ways we can get. The Puritans, who were Calvinists, believed that, but they didn't like the word accommodation. The word they chose instead was condescension. That word made more sense to them, but it said the same thing. And guess what word appears a giant handful of times in the Book of Mormon to describe God reaching out to people? God's condescension. Behold the condescension of God. I was going to say the condensation of God. That's not what I mean. behold the condescension of God, right? In my view, there's Joseph reflecting the Puritan theological heritage positively. Some of it they liked, some of it they didn't like. And it's stamped on them, right? That's what they grew up in. That is their context. And so, not surprisingly, the Book of Mormon contains a kind of argument with and acceptance of aspects of the Puritan heritage. Yes on this, no on this. So that's a theologian looking at this period and raising certain kinds of questions, noticing certain kinds of things that theologians make the big money to notice.
The big money, yes. All right. Locke, do you have any comments on that? Because a couple of things came to mind to me as Tony was speaking. I'm wondering what came to mind for you.
So I was captured by the discussion on education. And I agree with what Tony was saying. And I'm just really curious now. I'd like to figure out more why we valued education while rejecting some of the folks in the Northeast, but hiring some of them to teach us, or trying to anyway, and buying their textbooks. You know, what was driving us? I think I have some insight, but I need more. I think at some point we talk about how, you know, we want to teach geography because we can't send missionaries out if they don't know where they're going or how to get home. Sidney Rigdon is talking about the Far West Missouri Temple and some of the things they hope to do with it, which of course didn't get built. But he talks about how they want to educate their children to teach them to read and write so they can take care of themselves. So they saw education as a way to protect the vulnerable, mm-hmm. Those that were being taken advantage of by the more learned, he said. But there's more to it, I'm sure. I'd like to kind of dig into that at some point, but it won't be in this podcast.
Now, I think that's really fascinating, Locke. And, you know, there's the social justice part of me that wonders if part of the critique is essentially a social critique of the wealthy class that has access to stuff that we don't have access to. I mean, I think an aspect of our early movement is that there are a variety of points of social critique that are being lived out there. Communitarianism could be seen as a social critique of industrialization and the drawing of people from the countryside into the cities to work horrible, horrible factory jobs, as in England, you know, Dickens England. There's a critique there. And so some of our social justice impulses may be deeply rooted in genetic material from that period. I think it's interesting that we're critical of the educated but want to be educated. But if the critique is understood as a critique of privilege, you know, of the privilege of the 1% who have all the resources, that's different then. Right? It's not that we hate education, it's that we hate that privilege robs the rest of us. The privilege of some robs the rest of us of the resources that everybody should have.
That comment made me think of the irony of when we finally start converting the desperately poor from those factories in England, we soon give up on the idea of all things common and pretend we never taught it by Nauvoo. But the care for the poor is still there, and they're still doing some collective farming. But it seems like at a time when they might really embrace that, they pretended it was not part of them.
Yes. Well, and by the way, all these experiments had forgotten that there was a very long successful communitarian experiment called Catholic monasticism.
Yeah, they didn't think about that.
Right. That was connected to something they had already written off, but they could have learned some things from the Benedictines about how to do all things in common.
So from both Locke and Tony, we hear aspects of our context for the time period that we're talking about that are so important for us to keep in mind going forward, especially as we talk about the very beginning of our part of the Restoration tradition. There are a couple of things that came to mind as both of you were sharing. One of them that came to mind kind of goes back to where we started with our history principles. And that is, as we really begin to look more broadly at the context from which the early church came, we have in our own tradition idolized some aspects of our story and made them unique to us. And yet when we look at the broader context, they are not unique to us, whether it's the idea of living in community, all things in common, or whether it's the reality that during the revivalist period, to go out into the woods, into a grove, and have a spiritual experience was not unusual. And it was not unique to our founding story, but it's found in other faith traditions, founding stories from this same period of time, frontier religion, Christian primitivism, et cetera. And so those history principles that help us with the broader, to be open to the broader picture, I think will benefit us as we go forward in the in these episodes about our own story. There are some things we didn't touch on that I would like to hear from you about. One of them is, and it was kind of talked about, I think, Tony, you mentioned Andrew Jackson. And if we're going to talk 1830, which is where we are in today's episode, we can't really set the context fully without really talking about what was happening in United States history. We've talked about kind of the religious Northeast context, but that's set in a broader context, which is we're talking about the U.S. in 1830. Can either of you say anything about Andrew Jackson, 1830, and how that affected our story, especially with the Indian Removal Act?
I'll take the narrow view and then turn it over to Tony.
Okay.
We actually published in the church print shop behind Kirtland Temple, the Northern Times, a Jacksonian newspaper. So we were huge fans of Jackson, bought into the populism, and huge fans.
Tony, you want to add to that?
Yeah, it's hard for me in 2022 to look back on Andrew Jackson now with a lot of favor. I think what we would call the Indian Removal Act from 1830 is it's a slow genocide of First Nations peoples that was carried out by the U.S. Army and the U.S. government and their supporters. Literally, they death marched Native peoples from the Southeast all the way out to Oklahoma. What do you make of that? By the way, as we record this, I'm sitting in the temple, which is in Jackson County, and there's a statue of Andrew Jackson down by the courthouse. At least I think there still is. And this, again, is an example of current understanding, current experience of the deep, deep racism of American history and culture makes one go look back at someone like Andrew Jackson and think, I know he was populist. I know that when he was elected president, all kinds of frontiers people got to come to the White House and spit tobacco juice on the furniture and whatever they did. And so that sounds pretty cool to populists, but this also was a man who participated in a genocidal act. So what do we do with that, right?
Well, it's worse than that we saw God at work in gathering those Native peoples together.
Right, right.
We can reach him with our missionaries easier.
So but that's part of the context, right? And in a sense, there's a part of our early heritage where we're trying to value Native peoples, well, not in terms of their stories, but in terms of the Book of Mormon story. We will value you because you fit into our story. It's kind of, but still, there was at least an attempt to try and honor the worth of Native peoples. But honestly, it's happening in a context in which that is simply not taking place. And the people who had lived, whose lands these were for thousands of years, are now treated as squatters that need to be forcibly removed or killed. So that's a difficult aspect of our foundational context. It's important, I think, for us to acknowledge that our movement began in the United States in a period of like pretty much unconfessed, unrepented racism. And that does mark anything that starts there, and we need to be aware of that. And then we need to make changes that we can make in the 21st century. People knew what they knew and thought what they thought. I recognize that. They, like I, had limited vision and were marked by self-love and selfishness. And yet we can see that context as being ultimately kind of a harmful context to lots of people. So it's important, I think, to claim that.
Because we can't be unimpacted by what's in our political and social culture.
Right. Right.
Locke?
And then in another irony, we at times were treated like those native peoples. as at Hans Mill, you know, somebody shoots a 12-year-old in the head. I don't remember how old, a little boy in the head.
Yeah.
And says, "Nits will make lice." That phrase most often turns up when they're talking about doing it in native peoples.
I think that's really, a really important, we knew what it was like to be othered. Right.
Absolutely.
And we also knew how to other those darn Gentiles. Right. So.
And I would say we should know, not just knew, but we should know what it's like.
Yeah.
Now.
We do. Oh, absolutely. Experiences. Yeah.
It goes back to the ethics of our conscience and with our memory. I think, Tony, as you talked about earlier.
Yeah.
The other thing that came to mind, and Locke, I've heard you talk about this many times, and that is the climate of spiritual seeking of the time. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, and then I'll leave even more room for Tony. So the Smith family heritage seems to be one of seekers. Joseph Smith Sr., for example, this idea of seeking for some form of primitive Christian church. And not really connecting with any organized religion early on, but this desperate sense of seeking, which, as Tony has pointed out, seeking something that never really existed to begin with, but I think pretty important in the culture of the Smith family and many others.
Okay, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, I think, interestingly, that seeking context is still very much alive in the 21st century. It faces us with a paradox. On the one hand, positively, people are seeking for, I'll use my language, they're seeking for deep connection with what is transcendent, with what is beyond, with what is, you know, holy and different. And that's always a good thing. That's part of the human condition. We always long for and seek that which is greater than ourselves. God. We want to use that language. In the individualistic context of the United States and some other Northern European places, seekerism and the deep long-term commitments it takes to be a community are a bit of a paradox. they're a little bit of oil and water put together, right? Because I'm seeking deep connection with God, and I love this community that also seems to align with that. But then if the community makes some choices or decisions I don't like, then it's like, well, away with you. I'm going to go seek somewhere else.
So are spiritual, but not religious.
That's, yeah.
In some way are seekers today.
Yeah.
Yes, we can talk about that as we go through Pew Research and other pieces that inform us of the rise of spiritual seekers in our contemporary context. So I appreciate the conversations that we've been having in the being concerned about time as we go forward with our podcast. I wanted to just kind of recapture that we have explored some of the foundational pieces that are important to our discussions as we go forward with these episodes. And we've also established that the context, religious context, social context, cultural context, political context, all of those things are going to have impact on the story of the church. And we're going to explore some of that as we go forward in our historical and theological exploration as well. But before we come to a close from this episode, I wanted to give each of you an opportunity, if there's any last thought or comment or question you want to raise before we close this episode. So Locke, I'll start with you. Any last thing you'd like to share?
I'll just say I've never worked with Tony before, but I'm enjoying it so far and really looking forward to continue the discussion.
And likewise, I've never actually worked with Locke before in this kind of way. And so I'm quite enjoying it too. I think we're going to have a lot of fun together. I know we're going to disagree on some stuff, but I think we're going to have fun in the disagreement.
Well, our listeners can't see this, but there have been smiles and nodding going on, even in aspects that we may not all agree. So I would look forward to that as well. So I want to thank both of you for being willing to participate in these episodes and for today's discussion that kind of kicks this off for us. In our next installment in this particular series of episodes, our topic is going to move to Joseph Smith Jr. and the development of the early church. This is where I must admit I have the hardest time with the church history principle that, you know, we can't be judgmental about when we look back at this. So I'm going to be fighting that as we have our conversations. I'll just get that out in the open now before we start. So in the meantime, for listeners, be sure to catch up on all the topics that you can find on the Project Zion podcast. You can go to projectzionpodcast.org and see a list of all the series there. You'll see Locke and Tony in some of those as well. Again, I thank both of you. I'm Karen Peter. This has been Cup of Joe. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.